Welcome to the Pulse Refresh podcast. We are so excited to have you here and to welcome Lori McGinley to our show today. Lori is a licensed architect and now coaches climate tech leaders and future founders in the sustainability field via her company, Via Lucent. This episode is something special. We go to a lot of places emotionally and in terms of the broader discussion as it relates to marketing and the climate crisis. And there's lots of interesting details that I think you'll take home as golden nuggets. But before we proceed, we just want to dedicate this episode to the life of Andrew Peterson, who's no longer with us. He's one of our founders. And speaking of gems of human beings, much like Lori, Andrew was a gem as well. And we'll miss him dearly. And this episode is dedicated to him, his memory, and to his family as well. And without further ado, please enjoy.
Here is our CEO, Aaron Kremley, interviewing Lori McGinley.
Okay, let's get started, everybody. So, Lori, my first question for you is, lately there's been discussion about how climate tech startups should be evaluated differently in a kind of a different set of metrics because of the importance and because of the challenge that's before us. So my question is, you know, in addition to potentially being evaluated differently, what do you see as the key differences and challenges in running a climate tech startup versus just any technology startup? Because all of the above should have a huge amount of challenges. But what do you see that is so specific to this space, such that it would justify what it is that you do, which is so niche and focused in this wonderful way?
Aaron, I love that question. It has my head spinning about what the answer to this could possibly be. Can I ask you a quick question before I answer it directly? And I'm wondering what the discussion is about how climate tech companies should be evaluated differently. I mean, I have some guesses, but I'd love to hear a little bit more on your side of that.
Well, Laurel, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, there was, you know, in particular, talking about venture capital funding and how traditionally there's this kind of quick return that investors are looking to get, you know, within 5 years, we want a company to go public or something like that. And in a lot of climate technology, there's just a much longer time frame that's needed. And so if investors are looking into this space, you know, they need to evaluate it on more of a long-term investment that they could, you know, could still be profitable, but is not this kind of quick get rich hope kind of a model.
I have lots of thoughts on that particular criteria. A lot of the teams that I work with do that, Laurel. They need more time. And this kind of VC hockey stick curve growth thing doesn't really fit where they are and where they're going, and frankly, what we all need them to be doing. So if you're looking at, let's say the value proposition is bringing a utility scale renewable energy something to market. Maybe it's something we know. Maybe it's an improvement on something we know, like a better solar panel or better offshore wind. Or maybe it's something completely different, like quantum energy, where the renewable input is something like heat. So how do you look at that where there is an abundance of VC funding who wants to see a 5 to 7 year return? But you look at something that, you know, if you're talking about the next generation of offshore wind platforms, each platform can cost upwards of $50 million to make. And it's going to be a little while before you start seeing returns on that. So I honestly think there's a huge gap of funding between the very glacially slow and abundant government funding that's out there for these big utility scale things and the more nimble VC funding that wants a faster return, because the VC funding won't look at something that has a 10 to 15 year return. Or it has a lot of risk. It's a giant thing that's floating out in the ocean somewhere. So what is that magical funding mechanism? And I frankly would love to explore the answer to how do we communicate the value proposition of creating a utility scale renewable energy solution that helps hundreds of millions of people for decades to come? Is the value proposition of that only measured in dollars? Is it only measured in return on investment? Or is there a non-monetary value that we all need to be prioritizing?
Yeah, I think maybe this is just kind of, we're at the edge of what our accounting mechanisms currently can do across time. I mean, there are maybe some like multi-decade methods, but are there any multi-century methods of accounting? I mean, maybe some organizations that want to dole out kind of their foundation's resources over, you know, vast lengths of time. Maybe that's the closest thing, but on the investment realm, it's pretty tricky. But you know what? Before we like dive deep into solving this major gaping hole with society and how we fund innovation, how about we back up and can you tell us how you went from being an architect to getting into what you do now? And do I have this story right?
Yeah, you do have that story right. I am an architect and probably will never let go of the licensure because it was so difficult to get. I became an architect because I've cared deeply about climate my whole life. I grew up in rural Wisconsin, you know, in the early 80s with parents who recycled, which was extremely weird at that time. So my whole life, climate has been a central focus. And I thought if I was the one drawing the buildings would be better. And while that wasn't false, it wasn't really the biggest impact I could have. So I left practice and I became an owner's representative because I realized it was the building owner who made all of the decisions about the building having a better energy profile or having better materials in it or being a better shape and size for the community or being more durable, you know, to withstand future events. And it was a couple of years into my time of being an owner's rep that I looked up and I realized it's not enough. It's not enough. If I get to death's door and this is all that I have done, I will massively regret what I have dedicated my brain power to in my life. So I spent a year with a career coach and designed Viallucent with him, with his support. And what Viallucent does is it uses more of my unique abilities, including the architectural skills of synthesizing complex futuristic ideas into language that mortals can understand today. But it also uses a lot of things I've been practicing since I was a teenager, which is hanging around extremely intelligent, high-achieving, motivated people who feel that they cannot fail and helping them see the possibility that's oozing out of them that they can't see. So right now, I primarily act as a coach to climate tech founders, and I help them stay in the awesome zone through a combination of just helping them shed some of the survival instincts that we all have and helping them see possibility and using a tool that I've used on myself for about a decade, which is to design the future that I want, practice living there, and get into the habit of it, which makes it come faster. So I'm not saying we can predict the future, but the best way to predict it is to practice living in it and let it be your future. So I'm no longer drawing buildings. I'm no longer making decisions about what go into buildings, but I'm absolutely leveraging all of that knowledge in helping the genius climate tech founders be bigger and better and have greater impact.
What an amazing story. Well, yeah, because I don't think it would have been obvious to guess that you were actually grabbed by climate before you did that. So that is super cool. And I also like how, it sounds like you're never satisfied. There's always more that you can do and you just start taking on more and more. So helping a whole bunch of companies, that's a way to make a big impact. Is there any more you can share about, I don't know, like something rewarding that you've done and that you felt really great thus far in this effort of supporting startups?
Yeah, actually, I caught something that you mentioned before I answer your question. Is I have a piece of paper right next to my monitor that says what's bigger. And the reality, Aaron, is I'm in the middle of a transition right now. I'm starting a fund because the skills that I use every day, imagine, you know, you get up every day and you can do in your day enough effort to knock one domino down. And the way that I kind of look at my impact is how many more dominoes fall with the same effort that I do every day. And in helping climate tech founders, which is deeply moving and transformational work, and I love it, I'm able to knock down about 10 dominoes every day. And so I'm now at a place where I'm looking around and saying, how do I knock down 10 million every day with the same effort? How do we scale this up? But to answer your question, what's rewarding about working with founders is the moment when they realize that the skills that they have used that have gotten them to today will not open up the possibilities of the future. And that moment when they realize that what they need to do in the future, they already have, and they need to just start doing it. It's that clarity moment for me, because that's when big transformation starts to happen. And I adore that moment.
Okay, can you break that down a little bit more? So do you mean this sense that one needs to become somebody else before they can succeed, but actually they have a history of skills that they can build on, and if they just employ those, they'll get to where they're going? Or are you actually talking about the opposite, who we are today? Yeah, maybe you look at yourself and you're like, we can't do it, but who we're going to become by getting stronger and adding collaborators and, building up, we're going to transform into who could do what this ambition is. Because both would be somewhat reasonable approaches, I think. But which one are you talking about?
I'm actually talking about the one where, so imagine, let's think of a good example. Imagine you are a small team of five people. And maybe you've raised one or two rounds and you've done some amazing things, but as a small team of up to five people, all of you have kind of been everything. You've all picked up the slack. You've all been very versatile and been chief everything officers, right? But now you've just raised a really big fund and it's time to hire a team. So the skills that got you to where you are by doing everything a little bit all the time and being really scrappy are really not going to serve you in managing a larger team with more specialized experts on it. And you actually need to start using different skills, which you may or may not have. And I'm talking about things like letting go of the things that you are really good at and really fast at doing to make space and time in your mind to be able to be a visionary. And I truly believe that all of the founders are visionaries deep down, but there's this pervasive culture that we have to do the grind. We have to put in 70-hour weeks for 5 years and eat dirt the whole time you're doing it in order to be a successful founder. Well, when you do that, you live in a perpetual state of survival mode, and you cannot be a visionary from a state of survival. So the moment that I'm talking about is when you realize it's time to hire a team of specialized experts, and it's time for you to let go of the things that have felt like work in order to do the visionary piece that your team now needs you to do. That is both full of opportunity and absolutely full of fear for many people who I help through this.
Right. I mean, that makes sense, because it is taking on something new. But I actually think that, the people who would be equipped to do so are these kind of Swiss Army knife, multi-purpose individuals who only had the ability to do the many, many hats that they were wearing because of their versatility. So yeah, I could see that kind of being like just almost there for a lot of startups. Like if they're so close, if they could just apply that diverse, well, the ability to learn new skills quickly, if they could just apply that to the actual new skills that they now actually really need and not cling on to some of the things. I can see your point that people might feel that they're really good at, or maybe even this is the dangerous one, they enjoy doing. It's like, it's really fun to weld. But maybe that's not what's needed right now.
Aaron, that's exactly it. An analogy I like to use is, imagine you have a team of 50 people and your job is to cut a road through a thick, thick forest. And so you've hired on 45 people. You have a core team of five people who's really good with a chainsaw, really good at running the equipment, extremely efficient at clearing material. And so those five original founders, their tendency would be to grab a chainsaw or an axe or a shovel or whatever and get to work. The reality is what those five leaders must do put down the shovel, climb the tree, and scout the path. Because if you have 50 people just making a trail through a dense forest, you're going to have a zigzag line if nobody stops to get up in the tree. And as a core founder, as an original member, every moment that you're running your business, you have an opportunity to be a visionary. But you cannot be a visionary when you're stuck doing work, even if, or especially if, you love that work, if that work feels satisfying and you've been in the habit of doing that work for 5 years, so you're used to having that feeling, whether or not you loved it at the beginning of the 5 years or not. But the moment of growth happens when a leader realizes, when they put the chainsaw down, they climb the tree and they take a deep breath up there and they wait up there for a second to make sure that they're being clear with their thought so that their team can be efficient and effective and move forward.
I love it. Well, so you've got the right language and the right words to get people motivated. I mean, I'm feeling super motivated talking to you. So now explain to me what kind of process when you're working with a startup do you go through? You know, there's a lot of terms thrown around, like coaching. It can mean so many different things. You know, and there's a lot of nitty gritty that might be the type of thing you'd bring to a consultant and say, like, look, here are all of our numbers. Here are some of our technical challenges. Like, where are our blind spots? And a particular practitioner within a realm of expertise might be able to see something. But I get the sense that the type of work that you do isn't so tunnel visioned on a detail like that, but is more general. Like, listen, just be like you said. I think you said in the awesome zone. You know, so what does that look like? How do you how does that process play out?
Yeah, everybody who inevitably hires me does it for a different reason, and the reality is my coaching is bespoke to what you need. And this is something I'm very comfortable with. I have kind of a loose structure that's my proven process in that there are two phases of coaching. The first phase I call get to base camp. So people, when they hire me generically, tend to have like this sawtooth of growth. They'll do something awesome, but they'll get some kind of rough feedback. They'll hit the floor. They'll do something awesome because they're very motivated. And we all must know that they survive and do great, but they get bad feedback and they hit the floor. So the awesome zone for me is really about in this first get to base camp idea, where a lot of the work I'm doing in coaching is about reducing the time, the hours spent during the day in survival instinct mode, and allowing that person to have some white space in their life to let this visionary mode come back in. And really the second phase can't happen until the founders feel like calm and comfortable and on top of their game. Because a general theme is that they feel really kind of almost burned out at the point that they hire me. They're growing, or they need to grow, or there's some big challenge that's coming. There's some high stakes things that they haven't been performing on very well that they need to perform well on. And so we go through kind of an initial crucible of change. And I'm a very direct coach, so I prefer to go very fast. Sometimes that brings up a lot of fear for clients, but I'm always available to support people because I like to do change fast. So once we get to base camp with people, the second phase I call find your island. And this is really, it's called that way in honor of the amazing humans, the Polynesians, who went across the Pacific Ocean and back. They would be on an island and realize that they needed more resources for their growing community. And they would envision in their mind another island that had everything that they needed. They would put their wooden canoes into the water and they would allow that island to pull them into it. So I use that in talking about the future of a climate tech founder. If you know you need to grow tenfold in the next 2 years, 100-fold, whatever it is, create that future world. Life is balanced, where you have abundance, where your team is successful, where you have the resources you need to make sure your team can do what they do, where the right people are on board, and you hit those goals. So in the find your island phase, we've already dropped the amount of stress time that happens every day, the stress soup that people live in. And people really get to channel their inner visionary and create that future world. And then I support them in the practice of living in it so that they start behaving like that future self. And it starts to feel really normal to behave like that future self. And before you know it, you're living that life.
Okay. I mean, sounds fantastic. I mean, what it reminds me of is just this kind of, I think sometimes they talk about like a law of attraction or just kind of your mental state, being tuned to where you want it to be so that then everything else, is in response to it, which doesn't have to be like a esoteric or superstitious concept, because I mean, quite literally, we all respond to input. So, if you know, there could be a direct and immediate change in the way you reach out to a potential customer or a potential collaborator, if the way you're carrying yourself and just acting and the mentality that you're in is like what you're talking about. I mean, would you call that the island zone, or how do we refer to one's state in the zone that you're describing?
Yeah, what you brought up, Aaron, is actually a core theme that I work with a lot. It's so a lot of pitch coaches will talk about, you know, the language and the images in your pitch deck, and maybe even a script that they'd loosely like you to follow. A lot of the work that I do is helping you show up as the visionary who instills confidence in your investors that you can actually follow through on this. And that work is actually, it's probably more in the get to base camp area. Imagine for a second that you showed up to a high stakes conversation. You had an amazing pitch deck. You know your business inside and out. You can answer all the questions. You've got just the right deck. But you show up kind of tired and distracted. And maybe you look at your phone a lot because there's something really important that you're kind of halfway engaged in back at work. How are you going to come off to that person in that high stakes conversation? Whereas if you show up fully present, calm, confident, and exuding the visionary that you are, it leaves a very different impression on the person you're talking to. And it also allows you in that moment to be a visionary and be creative, because you've left behind any sort of urgent things that might have been gnawing at you if you weren't in that zone. And that piece of it is so important, especially when you're raising money. You know what your future looks like. You are the expert in your company's future. And your primary role, especially in initial meetings, is to translate that world to whoever you're talking to in a way that they can get on board with you. And a lot of the coaching that I do revolves around that. So it's, getting your deck right is important, but having you show up as that person who's fully in your zone of confidence is huge.
Right. It's so funny to me that the actual fate of humanity will depend on, was somebody tired and exhausted the day they pitched the solution? I mean, that's kind of scary.
That's really, I was muted, but I was laughing, Aaron. You're so right, but it's terrifying.
Yeah. Well, what's hilarious is that the cognitive shortcuts that we take all the time to just sort of like look around and be like, is anyone else doing this? Should I do this? Versus like, well, wait, what does everybody else, what status does this person have? Like, well, what do they think the status of this other person has? The kind of the quick decisions that we need to be able to make to exist as the social beings that we are, extended into this really crazy, vast question of like planetary maintenance, where it seems a little absurd that we would depend on these kinds of perceptions. I mean, but I guess it's just like capitalism itself, you have to work with the mechanisms that we use, even if they're a little clunky. And psychology, perception of others, something as blunt as a VC investment, without the full due diligence, they don't even understand the actual nitty gritty, and yet they're going to drop these millions of dollars. I guess we just have to work with the world that we have. Well, yeah. What do you think?
You know, in your first question that you answered, I was actually going to, this was my assumption, is that we were going to talk about how do you evaluate people who are in charge of planetary maintenance? And I'm totally stealing that phrase because it's so beautiful. Because Aaron, this is what we're talking about. Climate tech founders are the genius, brave, high-achieving people who have stepped up and said, I'll put my personal well-being on the line to say, I have a future that we can all live in. Why on earth would we evaluate these brave geniuses with the traditional VC model? It seems completely unfair. So yes, we live in capitalism. Yes, your climate idea must make money. It has to be a business. And are you going to float away on your raft of bound together dollar bills? I mean, when it gets bad, when it gets bad, as the scientists say that it may soon, what does it matter if you have wealth in the bank? How can we evaluate these teams in a way that's thinking more about the greater good of all of us living on this spinning rock that don't have an exit strategy off of the spinning rock? How do we evaluate these teams in a way that supports them more? And a lot of the work that I do is supporting them in a, hey, it's important that you're a balanced human way because you're doing something extremely difficult and ambitious that we all need you to do well. And honestly, that's the motivation for my work. I'm really committed to my clients because I need their idea to work. I don't have an exit strategy. I mean, none of us do. So how do we, I'd love to know what the model is that more, in a societal way, more justly supports the teams that are willing to go out and try this to see if it'll work.
Well, I'm going to steal that about the exit plan. Especially if a VC says, well, I don't know, what is our exit plan? There is no exit plan. Come on.
Yeah.
The moon, Mars.
It's, well, even if it's Mars, we haven't figured that out. I mean, the reality is we live on a planet we were evolved to live on and we're in trouble. All of the signs point to this time is coming to an end. And there's all of these teams that have solutions. And a solutions in many, many different aspects that range from, you know, software that helps humans do better to actual things that take carbon out of the air to the things that make and store energy. You know, what needs to give for all of us to start taking that more seriously? And I'm actually curious about, and I don't know the answer to this, this is more just kind of a thought idea. How do we get the 7 billion people on the planet to contribute the amount that they could feel like they could lose on a speculative thing that helps make the planet better for all of us?
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the things we've been talking about lately is this concept of having a dollar and wanting to divide it up to do the best thing for the climate. And how difficult that would be right now, because you'd be thinking, okay, I actually want to give $1 and I don't want to be, you know, bulldozed by some really good greenwashing hype that I should definitely just go buy this product because, you know, it's somewhat sustainable-ish, that probably wouldn't be the best use of that dollar if you're just trying to help the climate the best. But also, you know, we're in the carbon removal space, but that also wouldn't necessarily be the best use of that dollar, not the whole thing anyways, because, you know, it makes no sense to spend money removing CO2 from the air when the same money today could have been spent on not putting it there to begin with. But, you know, we know that we have to remove a huge amount of carbon even after we get to zero. And we don't want to be sitting around with no technology developed and scaled such that we can do that. So there's certainly some amount of every dollar that should be put to carbon removal. But then what about methane? You'd actually get much farther, much faster, just putting that money towards not putting methane in the air. And I think that the lack of information, this is kind of an information problem, and the lack of knowledge that prevents a VC or an individual or you know, or anything in between from knowing the best use of a dollar, I think is a huge problem. And then there's all of these marketplace startups getting capital like, hey, you know, we are where you are going to buy your carbon removal. Just pull up to our website and fill up your shopping cart and check out having bought some carbon removal, which only works in a kind of B2B sort of way vision today, but could eventually be a B2C scenario. But are dollars chasing the lowest price of carbon really the right mechanism to answer the question of how should you spend that dollar? It doesn't seem like it. So it seems like the there is no actual marketplace for solving the climate crisis yet. So that's kind of where my mind goes, that we need that.
It's so fascinating as a carbon removal expert and what you're doing with Pull to Refresh that you would put forth this what's the right answer. And I think it's so indicative of where so many people struggle with climate. And this is where my architectural background comes in. Architects are trained to imagine a puddle of water that was a kilometer in diameter and up to an inch deep in any one area. And that's what architects are trained to understand. So we don't really go deep on any one thing, but we understand a little bit of everything so that we can synthesize ideas. And one of the ways that I see that my unique brain, instead of knocking 10 dominoes down every day like I do today to knock 10 million dominoes down, is I feel a pull to help people untangle climate messaging. I don't know that it's a lack of information. I think it's a complete overwhelm of information and the inability to understand what's really true. You know, do I buy bamboo Band-Aids instead of plastic Band-Aids? Is the extra $6 on a box of Band-Aids that I spend worth it on that? Or do I put $6 into carbon removal? Or do I back a solar energy company? Or what do I do? Or do I just sit here with indecision? Because the human instinct during overwhelm is usually to do nothing. And your question is so good, because if it's true that we could do something to get 7 billion humans motivated to take one action, I think that the most important thing to do would be to help them find something that matters to their life. You know, if your thing is carbon removal, then here's a great way for you to be impactful on carbon removal. If your thing is agriculture, here's a great way to be impactful on agriculture. Or if it's energy, here's a great way to be impactful on energy. And I'd love to explore the idea of what can I do in my life? And again, my work that I'm doing with Climate Founders right now is completely transformational. People are different after they leave my service than when they started. How do I use that to get a whole bunch of people to step up and say, here's 10 cents or $10 or $10,000 that I can afford to lose. Help me find a place to put it where I know it's making a difference and I can connect it to meaning in my life. Because whether or not I make any return from that, I'm more likely to come back and try again because I see the meaning that it made in my life.
Well, then that opens up the question of, if you're going to coach these startups, yeah, maybe you could branch out and just coach the whole planet. Or in a way, that reveals, I think, what the big, at least one part of the big problem is to solve. And it isn't just what are the best ways to get solar on roofs and batteries in vehicles and carbon removed. I mean, we could sort of simplify to those kind of three main big things. And those things could pretty much get us there. But if you have the best technological answer to all three of those things, but you don't have that part that you were just talking about of making it meaningful for the individual, then we have now failed on another account, which is just the narrative account that, like, we have not provided the abbreviated, you know, hey, don't sweat the nuts and bolts, but, you know, feel a resonance that this is the correct thing and have that be good enough. I mean, it could be unrealistic to expect everyone on Earth to evaluate in grave detail the ultimate best actions that they could take for the climate. So we do need these kind of movements that create a trend and create a direction and a momentum and have leaders and influencers who can be trusted that are saying, yeah, we are all actually running in the right direction. This is good. And everyone could be like, okay, good, because I was a little worried there, but all right, I'm going to go with it. you know, just like in Bitcoin, not everybody understands the way the blockchain works, but they can be running in the direction with it anyways. So it seems to me like that's a big other missing component, other than, well, you know, the fact that there is no exact marketplace where, you know, the value can find the river that it should run down, you know, the way capitalism normally works, the price discovery mechanism. You know, there is not an actual value for carbon removal that you can have as a product. It's an impact versus many other things. You know, you can have a kilowatt of electricity and you can have a mile traveled. So putting batteries in vehicles is a value, a direct value, and putting, you know, solar on roofs is also a direct value. But removing carbon or preventing methane emissions, if anything, it's a burden. It's not an asset. It's a loss because you had to do something. And it can result in, you know, products and things that you could turn that into. That can only go so far in removing enough carbon, because the appetite for products is nowhere big enough to get where we need to go in less than like a couple hundred years or so, if you were going there only by selling products made out of carbon. So that price discovery mechanism problem, plus this narrative problem of how do people plug in to this in a way that is meaningful to them, even if that just means they're voting for somebody or, you know, they're boycotting somebody, like regardless of what the mechanism is, whether they're opening up their own wallets or whether they're choosing the policymakers that would basically mandate everything. So, you know, we don't have to even get into whether it would be companies that would pay or individuals that would pay or governments that would pay, because at the end of the day, it's all the same thing, which is that you need the will of the collective people to want it and to go there and be committed to it. And like, yeah, that's quite a coaching ambition. How do you plan to tackle that one?
There's so many pieces in what you just said that before I talk to you about how I'm going to coach every human on the planet, which is a brilliant idea. I love that. Thank you. I want to engage with you in a little bit of conversation about messaging around carbon removal, because that's your thing. Because there's a couple of things that you said that I fundamentally want to challenge. One, because that's who I am. In my coaching, I kind of push and poke. And if I see that you have a bruise, I'm going to push on it pretty hard until you cough up what you need to do in order to learn. And I would actually contest that there isn't value in carbon removal, that it's a liability. I think a carbon credit could be seen as an investment. And the act of removing a ton of carbon from the air is, I think we all understand this, in a planetary defense kind of a way, in a really important social impact act that we could all engage in. But I also think that there's value in that. You know, what's the value of a ton of carbon removed in 2022 when you're in the year 2050? Does it appreciate? And now that we can do this on the blockchain, we can keep track of it. You know, we can make sure it's still sequestered. We can track that original asset. And so, you know, yes, I can spend a kilowatt hour of energy driving X number of miles. You know, yes, I can have a better heating system in my building that emits less carbon, or I can go all electric, or I can lobby my lawmakers to make the grid where I live a higher percentage of renewable energy, or I could install solar on my own building, right? There's all these ways to do this. I also could say, I live in Minnesota. We have a fleet of snowplows and salt trucks that keep our roads drivable all winter long. And by all winter, I mean half of the year. I don't see a great way for those vehicles to be electric. I honestly don't. And so one thing that the city of Minneapolis could do is say, well, we're going to emit so many tons every year and just keeping the roads clear, you know, even at a minimum so that emergency vehicles can travel around, let alone all the humans that want to travel around. So we're going to buy carbon removal. It doesn't make sense to electrify this fleet of pre-responders, if you will. The salt trucks and the plows prevent accidents from happening. We're not going to electrify those, but we're going to invest in companies that are actively doing something like taking carbon out of the air using kelp, which is you. So How do you think of what you're doing at Polder Refresh as both a societal asset and a future investment? I honestly would love to hear your answer on that.
Good job identifying that one. Well, you're absolutely right that example is a good way of underscoring the value of carbon removal, where you're not going to be able to go green. And we could look at the whole big problem of like, okay, 40 gigatons, we could get that down to probably 15 by putting, you know, fully deploying solar and batteries and transport, but not all transport. So yes, the snowplows, the planes, certain things that may eventually be able to be electric, but that's going to take some time. So carbon removal, I actually see as needing to go way past that, not just let's see if we can get that 15 down to zero, because if we could, well, 15 gigatons, you know, maybe 15 companies could each be at gigaton scale. And there we go, we're at zero. Well, no, we have to keep going. We have to keep going to about negative 60 every year if we want to achieve the International Panel on Climate Change's estimate of needing a trillion tons of CO2 removal by 2100. And if we want to achieve that by like 2100, that's really, I think, procrastinating. And we were just saying earlier today, we're not going to solve the climate crisis through procrastination. So, you know, targeting like the 2060s zone of actually achieving that teraton, we could say, the trillion tons, that's where you end up needing to scale quickly and then get to about 60 gigatons of removal. So is this 60 companies that are each removing a gigaton each? And by the way, just for everybody listening who might not know the gigaton thing, you know, there's a megaton, that's only a million tons, and there's a kiloton, that's only 1,000 tons. And right now there's only companies in the kiloton scale. There are no megaton scale carbon removal companies, and there are definitely no gigaton scale. That and when you apply to get financing for this effort through companies like Stripe and Shopify and XPRIZE and all these ways that you can get funding for this, they're all asking for how you're going to get to gigaton scale in 20 years. So nobody even expects you to be able to do like that anytime soon. So it is a huge road that lies ahead. And so when I'm thinking about the economic value proposition problem that needs to be solved, and it can be solved, I'm not saying it's doomed, but I'm pointing out the problem to say that you cannot take a normal supply and demand approach and expect it to work, just like you can't do that with fine art, and they find ways to solve it, and NFTs are a brilliant modern implementation of this kind of age-old like scarcity approach for art, which has value, clearly, no question, has value. But how do you represent the value? How do you account for it? How do you use typical, you know, buying power chasing basically value? Like how do you use a marketplace to move things in the right direction? And that's where I would stand behind that. It is not actually a standard asset. And because there's work involved and energy consumed and carbon removal in the form of the equipment that you make and the maintenance of the system, it is actually a liability, at least from one way of thinking about the accounting of it. And so that what is needed is not a simple like, you know, have the money chase the lowest price, because one way that falls apart is the whole low-hanging fruit trap. There's maybe an easy way that you could offset the snowplows. And so if you just take a pure straight capitalism marketplace approach, then that city would quickly find that they could buy these low, you know, $50 offsets, and then they'd be good. And they would be good, actually, because accounting-wise, it wouldn't be fake. It's real. But the problem is that then no money chases the long-term solutions that actually are scalable. And you can't. There aren't any scalable solutions. So we're in a big problem right now. And so why would you buy $900 per ton carbon removal credits when you could get them for $50? And if we
so hold on, Aaron. I see you talking. I see you talking yourself out of possibility here. And my inner core. I just can't let you do this. I have to interrupt you.
Okay, great.
You are digging a grave that you will never get out of, and I'm going to make you stop. Because the point of this is not to dig a grave that you can't get out of it. The point is to say, hey, world, that's something, and it's going to help our lives be.
Except, wait, you know, the say that, sorry, say that again.
World. Which part?
You said, hey.
Don't dig a grave.
No, just.
Hey, world.
Hey, world. Continue.
Hey, world. I've got something. Take a look at it. It's going to make everybody's life better. Right. So, okay. There's no gigaton scale carbon removal company available to be funded today yet. There are ones in concept, by the way. But none of them are actively applying for funding right now. But what you can say is the scale that you can do, you know, maybe the solution that Paul de Refesh has today, maybe during 2020, it's a learning process. You know, maybe you don't take that many tons of carbon out. Maybe you don't take that many tons of carbon out in 2023, but you're working really hard to figure out how to be very efficient at pulling carbon out of the air using kelp. And from where I sit in Minnesota, nobody here is going to do that. Where's our ocean? Our growing season is like 3.5 months long, right? And so if you look at the possibility of what you have and you think about how to communicate the value of that, and I'm not talking about you reaching 7 billion people, but let's just say that your team has to reach 1,000 people in order to find enough of them who will get on board. Aaron, what is the value of what you are building that is worth investing in? Like, where's your message? Where's the hope in it?
I like how you reframe that.
That's what I do.
Well, so the value in what we're doing and you know, everything I have set up is to say these are the problems. These are the problems that actually we are tackling. And our solution to this problem is to actually, not worry so much that the price per ton is going to be high in the beginning, but use it as actually... a trajectory of doubling. So the way that this works is we just remove very few tons of CO2 initially, like 1,000 to 4,000 per year. And we can do this amazingly with just a handful of vessels that we have developed and prototyped, and we have driving itself around on the lake where I live, and making just a handful more of these, we can be able to remove a few thousand tons per year. And those can be sold as kind of premium tons initially, because like I said, you can buy them at the lower prices, but that premium ton model, while it may work for a handful of companies, is not scalable. However, what is scalable is doubling every year, so that the next year, all we're trying to do is if we did 1,000, we're just trying to do 2,000. And then the next year, we use the proceeds of that to say, well, getting up to 4,000 might require sort of a shift in the way that we do it. So then we develop at that point, just in time, that technology. You double it, you're at 64, you're at 128. You know, eventually you get to gigaton scale in about 20 years with that approach. Okay. And so while we don't know today exactly what our technology would be that can do gigaton, we know the general direction. Certainly you can grow kelp and, gather/grow kelp and get to gigaton scale, but mechanically, what is your mechanism? But that gives us this. So what people are financing is ultimately a roadmap towards something that becomes scalable in time.
Aaron, what if people were financing was the hope that you have the solution that's going to work? Because that's a piece I didn't hear in your story. I hear your math. I see you're very numbers and economics oriented. But the reality is you're a brave team that's figuring out how to use the ocean and biology to fix the problem that humans and machines made. there's not a lot of teams trying to do that right now. So what is it about your team that's going to be doing this in 20 years? Why do you care about this so much? Why is this the solution? What gets you out of bed every day to do this? And how can you say that in a way that touches my heart so that I open my wallet?
Well, you know, personally, the reason that I do this is because of seeing the impacts of the fires in California.
Yeah, where you live or near you.
Yeah.
What do the fires mean to you? Because we haven't had those here yet.
Well, I mean, well, what they mean to me is, loss.
Yeah.
That, yeah, that we lose the past.
Yeah.
The past that we grew up with and that we love.
I can hear how hard this is for you.
So, you know, when I moved back from New York and I realized that fire season was a thing and it wasn't when I was growing up, I left film, a medium that I really love, because I wanted to do something about a problem that I felt was much, much bigger. Mm. And yeah, so that is why I'm motivated to do this work and find the answers.
Aaron, I can hear how hard it is for you to say the California of my childhood has been fundamentally changed by climate. I can hear what that means to you in your voice. Can you connect for me the piece that connects that incredible sense of loss that's very personal and emotional for you to how important it is for Pull to Refresh to succeed? What does the success mean for you?
Well, the success means that we did the right thing and that we what does it mean? What it means is that we didn't fail. That as individuals,
I'm gonna redirect you for 1 second. Will you take me on a trip to your version of 2042 when you're taking a gigaton of carbon out of the air and your dreams have come true and everything that you're thinking of now is a reality? And will you describe to me how you've mitigated that sense of loss with the work that you've built, please?
Sure. Well, because we can remove 1 gigaton of CO2 this year, and we removed only 0.5 gigaton last year, we are on pace to remove 2 next year. And what this means is that we are on a trajectory to return to pre-industrial levels.
By 2042.
Yeah.
I'm asking you to do is time travel with me for a second. Mm-hmm. Let your logic brain relax just for a second. We're going to do an emotional journey. It's 2042. You've hit your goals. You've done your part. You've put your whole heart and your brain and all of your work ethic into it. You've scrapped, you've hustled, you've gotten a bunch of people enrolled in it. What does it mean to you to have done what you set out to do in terms of this? What have you built that helps heal what you've lost? Let me ask slightly differently. How does it feel to have built something that mitigates what you've lost?
Well, it will feel like justice. And it will feel like resolve and protection and defense.
Protection for who?
I mean, I would say for me personally, it's just protection from the things that I don't want to lose.
Yeah. So I'm pushing you on this because I want you to distill this story when you talk about pull to refresh. This is the piece that gets people to pay attention. When you share with them a slice where you don't melt into a puddle. Give people an emotional slice that feels safe and say, hey, when I was a kid, the world looked like this. And I left my film that I loved because it didn't look like that anymore. And I'm building something that will make it better. Let me tell you about my future world. You know, is California ever going to look the way that it did 15 years ago? Maybe not, not in our lifetimes. But are you going to build something that helps us feel safe the way that you felt safe 15 years ago? I hope so. Your challenge as a founder in climate is to help everybody you come in contact with understand how your successful future will feel to them. Because nobody can see it except for you. One common theme I have found of all the climate tech founders I've talked to, whether they were my clients or not, you all have a vision of the future that's better than the collective vision of the future.
At this point in the conversation, the audio started to glitch for about a minute and a half, but we resume the conversation with just a little bit less context, 90 seconds downstream. So here we are again. Thanks for enjoying the Pull to Refresh podcast.
Yeah, absolutely, Christian. I stay away from doomsday at all costs because it makes people freeze or flee. And again, if the message is overwhelming, our instinct is to do nothing. And most people, a lot of people in my personal life talk to me about climate because they know I'm doing something about it. And my role when they come and ask me a question is to give them a glimmer of hope for the future so that they take action. And I would say in any pitch or one-on-one or any conference that you talk at or anything that you're doing, you should absolutely bring people the successful vision of your future. Because they'll want to keep listening to that, and it may inspire them to take action with you.
Laurel, you were saying something earlier, I think, and it didn't get heard. Did we skip over what you were trying to say?
Yeah, I just was listening to sort of your response to Lori's question about like what value is Pull to Refresh providing, and I felt like you were so like, sort of like afraid to be confident in what you're saying. It was like, oh, it's a high price, or we don't know this yet, or it might not work, or like there was so much of that. And I feel like if somebody was to ask us what value are we providing, we wouldn't, you know, it's like delete all of that and just be confident in the value that we're providing. That was kind of my...
Laurel, do you want to take a swing at my question?
Oh, no.
Well, I'll do my best to not make you cry and airy.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, be careful,
Laurel. Thank you, Aaron, for participating. I really appreciate it. And Laurel, fair warning, most of the people I do with end up crying. So would you like to answer my questions?
I mean, I think it depends on who's... I feel like Aaron was going down this more sort of technical route of like, what's the cost or what's the technical value? And so maybe that's something where we can say, you know, Pull to Refresh offers a very scalable solution, more so than in our, you know, vision of the world, any other carbon removal solution. And it has very low emissions associated with it. And it's out in the middle of the ocean. So it's, you know, out of everybody's way. It doesn't negatively impact communities. And yeah, those are kind of the main values of it. But then I think if it was more of a marketing kind of what we're going into now of like, what's the personal or community value? I don't know. I'd have to maybe practice that. But
So I might, Laurel, like take any one of those pieces that you said and, mm-hmm. and try to expand on them a little bit. Like, why is it being out in the ocean in Assa? And I know why, but I want to get you to expand on this. Like, I live in the plains where we grow a lot of food for a lot of people on the planet. Like, why is it advantageous to take carbon out of the air out in the ocean instead of on our arable land, for example?
And the two main reasons are that it's incredibly scalable and just the sheer amount of carbon that we need to remove is so massive. And, you know, imagining that we're going to do that by using the land in any capacity, whether it's through factories with direct air capture or even, you know, reforestation and things like that, is just really, one, expensive and, you know, uses a lot of land that could be used for other things. But also we've seen that certain, you know, not so much removal projects, but like carbon offset projects, they have had bad experiences of, you know, indigenous lands being taken over for reforestation or wind projects getting installed in lower income communities, you know, just negative impacts on people on the land. And so by being out in the ocean, we can both scale up as large as we need to, but we can also avoid those negative impacts.
So that's a huge piece of telling this story to people. Because you are going to be out into the ocean, it's not like a wind turbine that we can all see and frankly are forced to live with. Right? It's not nice to live near a wind turbine, but we can see it and we know it's working and it's part of our story. But you all you're way out in the ocean where probably very few humans are going to lay eyes on on what you're doing. And so it's an important piece of your story to say, we get it. We can't use farmland for this. You know, we can't take over land that was quote unquote underutilized to do this. We're using a part of the planet that has fairly low survival production values for humans to take carbon out of the air. And to build a world where everybody understands what you all get this, which is why you design your project this way. But it's important to bring people into your world in a storytelling capacity, right? Help people, you know, I live 1,000 miles from a coast. Help me understand why the ocean is better than the world I know. So how do you weave in what you inherently know so much that you don't even question it anymore and make sure that it's a part of your value proposition for new people you're talking to about it?
Well, one way we can do that is, I think, bring them there and show them the beauty of just these underwater technologically, you know, aided, but otherwise fully natural solutions that are magnificent and beautiful, and actually transform the symbol and the image of hope from what we typically think of as like a redwood tree, like, oh yeah, that's how we're going to get out of this, and rebrand the climate solution to be, you know, majestic underwater kelp imagery that gives people the sense that the future is going to be one that is safe.
So that's a huge piece of your story. You're using something that already exists on the planet and you're aiding in its ability to be effective. And that differentiates you from a lot of these solutions, right? You know, there's no chemicals involved. You're not modifying buildings. Can I assume that it's relatively low energy intensity per ton?
Yes, extremely low compared to just doing like a machine you plug in the wall and it sucks CO2 out of the air, you know?
Right. So zooming back out to kind of how this all got started before I took you down this path is, it's every climate tech founder's job to help everybody you talk to understand why your solution is the one. A piece of that is connecting your personal connection to it. And a piece of that is being it explaining in very, very plain language what Aaron and Laurel just did. It's out in the ocean. This is not food land. This is not taking over somebody's rights. It's very low energy intensity. It's gorgeous. It's part of nature. And it's doing this thing out here while y'all are living your lives over there. this is the best route to our successful future. So when all climate tech founders can do that, explain the value of their future in the language their audience can understand, I truly believe more people will find a path to contribute to climate. Because again, my original idea is when you're overwhelmed with information, you just freeze or you do nothing. So if these messages could come through in a more clear, more direct, here's how you take action, here's our link to donate, you know, who do you know who's a VC? I truly believe that's how we start coaching 7 billion people. Because most people I talk to feel totally and completely defeated by it, and they just don't know what to do.
Lori, given the short attention spans prevalent on social media and you know, the number of avenues available to tell what in, you know, this whole vision can definitely be condensed down into, you know, a 2 to 3 minute summary where somebody can kind of digest the entirety, start to finish, of the path of this vision basically unfolding. But, you know, with attention spans being so short, how would you recommend, you know, what can you say to somebody in 20 seconds that you think of what you've heard from Aaron and Laurel so far? What is the best hook, so to speak, if you only have 20, 30 seconds of somebody's attention?
I would say, Christian, that there's no one hook. I would personally suggest a strategy that's thousands of hooks. So if we're talking about a 20-second attention span, how many different hooks can you generate that are 20 seconds long? And again, just to use the example, the language of success of the VC who's the right fit for your team is probably vastly different than the language of success than if you were crowdfunding with your known people in your network, right? So for example, if you were doing a crowdfunding round, you'd probably say something like, "Hi, I'm Aaron, I left film, this matters, this is important, here's my vision of the future, come and buy one of our rewards." You know, if your version to get to the right VC who understands what you're doing and is willing to go on the journey with you, it's probably a lot more like, "Here's how deeply we understand carbon credits. Here's how deeply we understand them today and in the future and how you make money off of them." You know, if you just put those two things out of context, you might not even be talking about the same company. But there's no one magic bullet when it comes to messaging. And if you're talking about social media in particular, I would strongly encourage you to imagine being a member of the audience who you need to enroll and actually imagine you're talking to them, because that's how you're going to broadcast in a way that finds them.
This is really, really great, Lori. So we also have Dan in the audience who just jumped in. I noticed, Dan, that you have you've had another conversation happening today. Lori, can you kind of give a summary for Dan, who's very active in this climate tech VC space, a summary of you know, just what we've been talking about over the past almost hour and a half?
Sure. Hi, Dan. What we've been talking about is how to kind of untangle the messaging around climate. And actually, it had hit on, should climate companies be evaluated in a different way? And not to say that a climate company doesn't need to be successful in a capitalist society, but we had kind of touched on, if we're talking about a utility scale renewable energy project that isn't going to have a return in the first 10 years, how do we evaluate that differently? Because a utility scale energy project will impact hundreds of millions of people. We were also talking about how to break up messaging into the pieces that your particular audience can understand. And really that all climate tech founders kind of have this responsibility to let us know what your vision of the future is. Because it's your job to enroll a whole bunch of people who believe in your mission, you know, whether that's your cousin or your neighbor or VCs or government or whatever it means. Climate tech founders it's a unique breed. You all believe in a future that none of us can see. And most people don't have a very good plan about how to keep living on this planet. And every climate tech founder I've ever talked to has a plan about how to make this a better place. So how do we leverage that ability to enroll millions of more people in contributing to and caring about climate, you know, whether that be in a monetary contribution or coming to work for a climate tech company or just contributing in some way?
Thank you. That was a great summary. And I've just invited Dan Miller to speak if he has any responses, but the app might be glitching on me. So if so, Dan, feel free to request again and I'll let you in. Great. Well, what else, you know, because I wasn't expecting to have an emotional experience, I'm like disoriented and thrown off. But Lori, so what else do you think we should chat about today while we're on this call? We've got another 15 minutes or so.
Well, Aaron, first of all, I want to just say one more time how proud I am of you and how brave it is. And frankly, most people who go on this journey end up crying with me because that's part of the transformation that I do. We need to get out of our heads and into our hearts. If we're only looking at the intellectual pieces of all of these innovations and ideas, it's really hard to explain that. Every climate tech founder I've talked to, you know, has a highly technical, complex version of the future, and six elements of it we've never heard of before. So if we're going to get on board with your idea, we first need to go to that piece of understanding why you personally care about it. And if there's anything I'd love to touch on in the next 15 minutes is this idea, and it's selfishly, it's something that's very present in my mind. How do we all have a greater impact? Going back to that sign that's on my wall next to my monitor of what's bigger. How do we get 7 billion people to contribute what they can afford to lose to funding these companies? Because we're not going to get to a solution of planetary success if at least some of these solutions don't get implemented at a huge scale.
Yeah, well, I have an answer to that question. Which is that we need a huge amount of carbon removal to be possible. And we need to track all of the methane prevention options and deployment of solar onto roofs and batteries into vehicles. And there needs to be the right marketplace. I don't think we have the right marketplaces yet, but the right marketplace would be where you can come with a dollar, whether you're, you know, Stripe trying to offer carbon neutral transactions of sales, or whether you're Microsoft trying to be carbon neutral as your, you know, operation, or just an individual or a small business even. You know, or, you know, if someone who has a couple kids who says, well, at the very least, I would like my family to be carbon neutral and I can afford to do it. There needs to be that mechanism to be able to come in and say, here's the money that I have. Please put it in the right places. And if you just give it to Poultry Fresh, we're just going to put it all towards carbon removal. And that's fine. We will do that initially through crowdfunding and other direct sales that we're working on. But ultimately, to really have a solution that's intelligent and not just narratively dependent, but is actually the right thing that any scientist, you know, would be proud of, would be to actually have that be determined by every year, reevaluated. And I think this kind of happens already through the International Panel on Climate Change, but I think that that needs to be more specific and then there needs to be, everything needs to get interconnected so that you can put your money into one spot. And if the scientist that year had said, look, this percentage of that dollar should really go to solar deployment, it will give us the most prevention of emissions right now. But we allocated this amount because carbon removal needs to be developed. And what I fear that right now isn't happening is there's not enough money going into carbon removal, and all of these other important things are actually getting the money, but there isn't this wisdom that we can create to say, look, you need to also support these other things. And then in the future, this whole thing is going to flip, where eventually it's going to be like, yeah, this year, you know, the 20 years from now vision that we're talking about, 90% of all of the dollar that you'd be putting in is going to be spent on carbon removal, and only 10% because we will have gotten all of our batteries into all the vehicles. All the roofs will be solar. There'll be more always renewable that we can deploy, and there'll be more methane that we can prevent, but we will have hit all of those things. And so, you know, what can we do today to make sure that we have the right technologies getting developed so that in the future, we know what to do with that 90% of that dollar?
Dan, I see that you made it to the stage. I'd love to give you a chance to contribute.
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, you were talking about communications earlier, and I would, and the room this morning was on exactly that with David Fenton, who's probably one of the leading climate communications people, and that will be on replay, so you can just check that out. And really interesting, more about how do we reach the public about the climate crisis and the challenges of doing it, but some of the strategies for doing it as well, which I think clearly set out by David. So really interesting stuff. Number one, you were talking about companies and how do you know they're doing the right thing. I'm part of something called Project Frame, FRAME, and you can see that at projectframe.how, HOW, which is a sort of how do you go about assessing climate impact of companies you might invest in. So it's for venture capitalists to have a sort of a common approach to evaluating the climate impact of companies and products and services and things that they're thinking of investing in. So that's a little useful information for people. And then the last thing you were talking about, I agree with you that we're going to have to put a lot of money into carbon removal because that's waste disposal for past emissions. So there's no one around to pay for it. So government's going to have to pay for it. But when it comes to renewable energy, fortunately, the government doesn't really have to pay for it. As long as it sets the rules on phasing out fossil fuels, private industry will step in and put in the trillions of dollars needed to build up clean sources if the rules are, the policies are, that we're going to be phasing out the dirty ones. And now, of course, they still should put a lot of money into R&D and subsidize some of these earlier markets. But, you know, wind and solar are already cheaper and fossil fuels. But unfortunately, all of the growth in that is just going to supply new energy demand rather than replacing fossil fuels. So we have to make that happen. And we can do that with policies, which are very inexpensive to implement. It'll shift the, you know, make fossil fuels pay for their true cost to society. And then if you do that, then renewables will be much, much cheaper, relatively speaking, and will take over. So anyway, those are some few high-level thoughts. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Any thoughts on that, Laurel? I mean, Laurie, sorry.
Yeah, you were touching on and something that we brought up right at the beginning of the hour, which is it seems like there's a deep need for funding that's in between the glacially slow funding of early scientific ideas that comes out of government and also the policy that you touched on. It is amazing how much money can be released when the policy changes, and it is relatively inexpensive. It's really just a cost of time to get the policy enacted. And then the more nimble ability of VC to be able to fund stuff in a short period of time and really get action moving. And one of the questions that I had is, what is that in-between funding stage? Because with these ideas that you won't see a return in 10 years, that really don't fit into the VC model. And if you fit them into the current government model, now you probably won't see a return for 15 years. It really seems like there's a need for a somewhat in-between space to fund these larger, big infrastructure ideas, like the next generation of offshore wind energy, which will be significantly bigger floating platforms that are a lot more expensive to build and should have a significantly higher energy output once they're built. And I don't have an answer for this. I'm just curious and would love to hear your opinion about, is there something that's in between government and VC, and what is it?
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the good news stories of recent times because, you know, 10 years ago when we were investing, it was sort of VC investing was sort of a specialized boutique subject, you know, and mainstream finance was not part of it. But just in the last couple of years, you know, partly because of climate impacts becoming very obvious and growing, mainstream finance is starting to get into the ESG game. And this is, call it private equity as opposed to venture capital. And private equity is simply later stage venture capital, one way to think about it, but includes like bank financing and things like that as well. That is now looking for places to put it in the clean energy space, and they're having trouble finding spaces because or opportunities to invest in because of the dearth of investment in the past. And so there's not a lot of companies that have made it to the, you know, growth stage that are still private. I mean, there are great examples like Tesla, and there's others, you know, but still there's a lot of stuff going on, especially in the carbon capture space. So one of our companies, Fonte, is now becoming a leader in this next generation of carbon capture, and they're getting to be a big company now and a big opportunity for investment. And they just raised $125 million last year, and then it was oversubscribed. So there was a lot of money, and now there's even more money coming into the space looking for opportunities. So I think, and this is all very recent, I'm not saying this is the way it's always been, but this is very recent. So I think the good news is if you have a good company that has grown, you know, using venture capital to the point where it's able to deploy solutions that can, you know, make money and things like that, like offshore wind, I think you're going to find a lot of financing. And then there are also specialty financing opportunities like Generate Capital in San Francisco, which made its mark, and it's now multi-billions. I don't even know how many billions they have. They have a lot of billions. And what they do is they act in a sense like a bank, or they used to do this, act like a bank financing, but for clean tech things that banks wouldn't invest in because they were too new. You know, back when solar and wind was a new thing for making money, and then now it's mainstream, so you can get regular financing. So they're getting into the carbon capture and some of these newer technologies. And they're also owning and operating them as well. So let's say you have a new technology, I don't know, let's say for refrigeration, low carbon refrigeration in a supermarket, but the supermarket doesn't want to pay for it up front. Well, these guys can step in and buy it from the company providing the technology and lease it to the supermarket so that it doesn't, you know, they can just take advantage of the savings month to month rather than having to put a lot of money up front. So there's a lot of ways for finance to get involved. And the good news is, in really only the last few years has sort of mainstream finance stepped into the game. And so I think that's actually one of the a lot of negative things, of course, that we're facing with climate. But that's, I guess, one of the positive signs I've seen recently. Thanks.
So the message of hope I just heard from you, Dan, is that a lot more people are getting into the growth stage. And the opportunity here, or maybe the challenge, is that not enough investment happened in enough companies that they're at the growth stage when there is money interested in looking at them. I actually see that as an incredibly positive change. And it's just a matter of getting these climate ideas to the stage where they're ready to take advantage of that funding. That's great news.
Well, we've reached 1:30. What an amazing conversation today. You know, this is going to be a memorable one because of the just, I think, impact it's going to have on the work that we're doing at Poultry Fresh. And I find ourselves very likely referring back to this conversation and using it to step into the future that you're challenging us to create. So thank you, Lori, for really, I guess, seeing the full value in any project, regardless of how early stage it is and regardless of the current mentality that maybe is, you know, kind of built up in the day-to-day of the difficulties and then the really like tunnel vision, like people have a problem with this, we got to focus on that. But, you know, talking to you today, Lori, it's really been great to just zoom out and look at, okay, like, we have to be visionaries here, and we have to have our core drives be something that we understand as individuals and can even communicate in an effective way. And then also we have to have the benefits of what's unique and differentiated about Poultry Fresh be like clearly stated and out in the open for people, and then also customized, you know, per the audience because there are millions of reasons why what we're doing is so great. And so yeah, it's been super awesome to have you here today and to learn about your background and your journey, and then also just kind of see a good sample of like, wow, so this is the work Lori does. Amazing, amazing job today in this chat. Anything that you want to share before we close it out?
I just want to thank all of you for the opportunity to have the conversation today. The work that I do with clients is so cloistered even. I mean, obviously, I don't publish any of those conversations. They're all confidential. And I really appreciate the opportunity to look at this from multiple scales with you all today. And Aaron, thanks for letting me take it down to the personal level with you. The last thing that I want to say is this work can be transformational on so many levels, whether you're a founder who's making a big change or an investor who's looking to invest in the climate, or somebody who's not an investor who's ready to be one and wants to look in climate. The reality is because this is so personal for all of us who live on this planet without an escape strategy, the way that I see addressing climate is inviting and supporting as many people as possible through this change to the point where they get to where they're having a big impact on something that really matters to them. There are a myriad of ways to have an impact on climate, and I see the fastest route is to get people to find one that matters to them, that's really personal, that has an actual impact. So thank you for the 90 minutes today to explore this with your team. It's been really enjoyable for me.
Absolutely. Have a good one, Laurel. Lori. Talk to you all later. Bye-bye, Laurel, as well, and Christian and Andrew. Okay, bye-bye,
bye, everybody. Thank you.
Great room, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Pull to Refresh podcast. Please be sure to check out our website at www.pulltorefresh.earth and follow us on all social media platforms at Refreshing Earth. Those links, as well as links to Lori's social media and website, will be in the show notes for today's podcast. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Until then.